Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Generation Report. My name is Paul, and I have with me a guest, Brandon Quittam. Welcome, man.
What's up, Paul? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I let guests introduce themselves, so I'll give you the floor.
All right. Where do I even start? Let's see. I grew up as a young person in the suburbs of Minneapolis in Minnesota. One thing that stood out is I was constantly starting little businesses. Car washes. I had a pop soda pop empire for a couple of years. Employed all the neighborhood kids. I stole my parents' beer and wine coolers and soda out of the fridge and went door to door and started selling it when I was like five. The neighbor guy's like, "Your parents know you're selling me beer below market price here?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course they do." I go home and learn my first lesson about you got to buy your inventory before you can sell it. It's not all profit. Grew up playing sports in high school, went to school, studied mechanical engineering, then shifted over to business. I was a good math student in high school and realized at a top 10 engineering school, I was pretty average in the calculus and physics department once I got to the big leagues. And then I started my career at Oracle selling ERP software. And then I did a stint with startups and sold a couple companies between 2014 and 2018, found Bitcoin, and sort of realized that my political ideology, my life experience up to that date really, really made the Bitcoin thesis make sense, or it made sense to me at least. And realized that there's a way to change the world through technology rather than through politics. And prior to that, I would say I was a young person who was very ideological. I wanted to change the world, leaning left. And I got pretty disenchanted with the politics and watching. I was making phone calls for Bernie Sanders in 2016. I watched how that went and got pretty disillusioned. And Bitcoin as an idea is, let's say, zoom way out, as a political ideology, is essentially the recognition that you can either play in the political game and just vote harder, or you can build technology that makes the old system obsolete. So a little bit of Bucky Fuller there. And I'm very firmly on the camp of build tools that are hard to stop and sort of build the world you want to see. And that's sort of what Bitcoin represents. And so once that all came into picture, which honestly took months or maybe even a year of serious study before everything clicked, I decided to just shift career entirely. At the time, I had a small business online. Wife and I spent 5 years traveling and working remotely when we were building those small startups. And yeah, the business kicked off cash, gave me an opportunity to study and move into a new industry. And then I've been working full-time in Bitcoin since about mid-2018 until now. And I started at my current company, Swan, in 2019. I was employee 4. Now we're at 170, multi-billion dollar company, very serious financial services company in Bitcoin land. I think most people, the easy analogy is Fidelity. Fidelity's financial services centered around equities. And they, you know, any way you want equity, they'll figure it out for you. We're kind of going down the same route, but for Bitcoin. So you can just buy it spot. You can hold it in an IRA. You can set up recurring purchase plans. You can custody it with us, all different things like that. Yeah, and that's pretty much where we are today. And let me tie one more thing in. I'm a obsessive rabbit hole dweller. I love ideas. I love understanding how things work. I think my wife would find that to be annoying sometimes because I get so obsessive and I don't accept the surface level answers for anything. I want to dig in and see how they work. And so, yeah, I'm always learning different things. And during 2020, first half of the year there, COVID comes in, the world's going crazy. And I didn't know how to make sense of the world. And I started reading like crazy and crazy and crazy and found a book we both love, The Fourth Turning. And through that exploration, I thought that was probably the best way to view the current landscape in the world. Things started to make sense. And I read it 3 times, started writing about it, talking about it. I was very obsessed with it. And it gave me some hope. It gave me a context for the long arc of history and sort of where we are in the world. It's not a linear path off the cliff. This is a cyclical thing. And so, yeah, I'm sure we'll cover that today, but that's me.
So for the listeners, Brandon and I got familiar with one another and with one another's work through an essay that you wrote in 2020 that was published in the fall. It looked like it took you some time to write it because it was quite long. But the essay was called Bitcoin and the Rhythms of History, tapped into basically the themes that you were just talking about, how this new financial instrument or new financial system in a way is emerging in this context because of kind of where we are in this cycle. But before we kind of dive into some of the nitty gritties on that, how did Swan Bitcoin get started?
Yeah, we started end of 2019 as primarily an education focused company. And what most people don't know is we actually started an entirely different product, which the thesis was, if I gift my mom $100 worth of Bitcoin, over time, that's going to incentivize her to learn more because you have skin in the game, you own the asset, all of a sudden you just pay attention more. So the idea was we had a platform to gift Bitcoin and then we hold it for 1 year and put this huge education platform behind it. So at the end of 1 year, you taught them all about Bitcoin, they know what they have, and there we go. And then about 3 months later, we said, wait a minute, there's no Bitcoin-only brokerages out there. Everyone's using our platform simply to buy Bitcoin. Maybe we should make a brokerage platform. And then, yeah, threw the whole old system away, built a brokerage called Swan. And again, our focus is on education. And the reason is we believe that Bitcoin is a paradigm shift. And the only thing stopping it from reaching its maturity, which I would estimate to be around $100 trillion based on today's economics, which is a big statement I'm happy to defend. The only thing stopping that maturity or that growth is education and time. And so we believe it's our mission to educate people and teach them how this thing relates to their life, how they can use it, how it might implicate political changes in history. Simultaneously, I think it's a good business decision to be content first because that increases our brand. It makes customer acquisition very low cost, very scalable. And we also found that the more you learn about Bitcoin, the more you buy, which kind of makes sense. You start with a little dip, dip your toes in, you learn a little bit more. And before you know it, you're 90% Bitcoin. And usually you don't throw 90% of your wealth in right away, but over time the price has gone up. So even a 10% allocation becomes large over time. That's one.
Cool. Awesome. So at the risk of boring anybody who knows exactly what the fourth turning is and has gone down the rabbit hole, if there's anyone who might still be uninitiated, here is the quickest bare bones summary I can give of this idea that we're talking about and this book by the same name. So the fourth turning was a book published in 1997 by the historians and demographers William Strauss and Neil Howe, who theorized based on studying American generations going back to the inception of the country. They were convinced that America was going to head into a period of enormous social, political, and institutional upheaval in the early decades of the 21st century. And they gave their basic reason for this as generational change. What was the process like putting that essay together called Bitcoin and the Rhythms of History? And I believe it's on your own personal website, is it not?
Yeah, my name, brandonquidham.com. You can find that one. It's also my pinned tweet. It's long. It's not for the faint of heart. So I made a summary on Twitter. If you go to my Twitter profile, you can read like a 5-10 minute read instead of like an hour long read.
So was the reaction within the Bitcoin space immediate as soon as it started to go viral?
Yeah. I'll tell that story. So first, a personal one. 2020. I'm cooped up. It's summer. I don't like what I see. The world is going nuts. I see neighbors, I see peers, I see friends succumbing to what I would consider lazy thinking and sort of spineless collectivism. And yeah, okay, I always thought some people didn't think for themselves, and I get it. It's a cognitive burden to make sense of a complex world. It's easier to outsource your opinions to people you trust. We all do it. I do it too. But what I was really surprised about is the percentage of Americans who would throw all of our values, or what I thought were our values, out the window for the sake of this do for the greater good type of thing. And that scared me, to be honest, like neighbors calling the cops on their friends, or like neighbors calling the cops on each other because there was too many cars in the driveway for Thanksgiving. Stuff like this blew my mind. And it honestly scared me. It made me believe that I can't trust the neighbors. I reduce my social circle a little bit. I was very outspoken against what I believe and still believe to be poor decisions. And anyways, there's a whole rabbit hole there. Yeah. So finding the fourth tourney was like, whoa, okay. I can explain this collective impulse. This is a natural thing. It intuitively makes sense. Historical analysis reinforces that intuition. So, okay, the world's going crazy. What do? Well, in order to make big changes, we do need to collectivize. We are a social species. So in the time of need, we do band together and we make very, very harsh us, you know, either with us or you're against us. Neil's favorite line there. And so I saw people's reaction to say, no, we got to band together to fight this thing. Don't think too hard, you know, get on the mission. And so, okay, I can give these people some compassion now. I can put the guard down and made sense of the whole thing. And then I layered that on Ray Dalio's long-term debt cycle, which I think fits nicely. I layered it on, of course, with the Bitcoin thesis and kind of a joke making fun of the Bitcoiners is we see everything through the orange tinted Bitcoin glasses. And so there's a whole category of content where it's like, I read the fourth turning and I just jam it through the Bitcoin lens and then I outputs an essay. And I'm extremely guilty of this. But I think there's a way to make fun of us because we're so obsessive for sure. But also the other side of this is I do believe that Bitcoin is extremely revolutionary. I think the technology itself and the future implications are going to be on par with the internet or the steam engine or microprocessor or fire or whatever analogy you want. I do think it's on that type of scale. And so here it comes. I publish it. Honestly, it took me about 6 months of very intensive research, study, writing. I sort of had to backfill my own historical knowledge to make sure I really understood what Neil was saying. And I went very deep into the 30s and 40s of America because I think that was the easiest for me to grasp and relate to the modern times. And so, yeah, a lot of writing, a lot of editing. Published it in, sometime fall 2020. Went mega viral. It was wild. I watched Bitcoiners. I bet I sold over 1,000 of Neil's books, maybe more, just from the essay. And so many people have read this thing. And yeah, that's pretty cool to see. Yeah. I also got a lot of pushback. A lot of people are like, especially people who didn't really do their homework or like they skimmed it. They're like, this is horoscopes for intellectuals. Or I heard all kinds of funny, shallow critiques. And in some ways they're right. Right. We should not view this as a prescriptive view of the future. This doesn't tell us the future. This gives us a framework to make sense of the world in some way. And then we have to use our own intuition and our own thinking to figure out where it's going to go. We're just increasing our chances of being right about the future. And so just a caveat that I'm sure you're aware. I'm sure your listeners are well aware, but I always have to hit that one. That's the book.
Nice. What I anticipated when I first started working on my this podcast is that absolutely the sort of lowbrow critiques would come flying out of the woodwork quickly, and my only chance to essentially make an argument for the essential basis of the ideas and then to build upon them was to make the arguments as precise as possible. And I think that that's true of a lot of people who dive into these ideas.
Yeah, one comment on that, if I may.
Sure, yeah.
Creating content is very easy to critique on the sidelines, right? We're on the internet, we scroll, we read a comment, barf out a response. But I respect anyone who creates content and publishes it out in public. That is a seriously challenging thing. If you never wrote an essay and published it on the internet and tried to get people to read it, then honestly, your critique of other people's content is kind of flat because it is hard and you put a lot into these things and it's quite personal. These are my ideas. I care about them. I want people to read them. I want people I respect to like them. And that alone is a whole thing to get over. And it's not easy. To go a step deeper, especially writing, but any content applies. It is a superpower because it forces you to get sharp with your thinking, right? I have unlimited ideas. I could write an essay a day for the rest of my life and never run out of ideas. But when I sit down to write something, then I figure out how good my ideas are, right? They're normally half-baked. And then you write them and you go, oh, wow, there's gaps in my thinking. Oh, no, I don't understand it as well as I thought. shit, I better get smart here. I better figure out what I actually want to say before I publish this thing, or I'm going to embarrass myself. And that process is how you refine your thinking. And it forces you to get sharp. And so that's the writing price. The next thing is, for me, I need to get ideas out of my head. It's easy for me to have too many and feel overwhelmed. And so I think the publishing process is cathartic in a way. I get to package up my thinking as best as I possibly can. We'll call it 99%. You don't want to go to 100%. It'll take you for the rest of your life. Publish it at 99% of your capacity, get it out. And then you sort of timestamp your ideas. I can take a deep breath. I can distance myself. I can move on. Otherwise, there's just too much in there. So it's good to get them out. And it's fun to go back and read your old stuff and look at how stupid you were 5 years ago and how embarrassing you were. And side note there, if you're not embarrassed by your previous work, it means you're not trying, you're not growing, you're not stretching. So always be embarrassed by yourself 5 years earlier. That's the goal.
Absolutely. What you were saying before about attraction to interesting ideas, a lot of people in the finance and the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency spaces got introduced to the world that they're in now, reading The Sovereign Individual, which was a book that came out about the same time as The Fourth Turning did, and had a similar major ripple effect impact on lots and lots of people. So The Sovereign Individual, what was that book's biggest influence on the Bitcoin community as it's evolved to be now?
Yeah, definitely. So I don't know what happened in 97, but we got Sovereign Individual and The Fourth Turning. That is totally nuts. Both books, I would say, stand up the test of time. And most books in this category, let's say, complex system thinking, predicting the future, trying to model the world, make future predictions. I think most of those books do not do well 20 years, 30 years in the future. So shout out to those authors. I'm a big fan of The Sovereign Individual in terms of a collection of ideas. I found the book actually not very good. It was a slog. It was too long. You could tell there was two authors, just to pick on these guys for a minute. It'd be like page one, share an idea, page two, the same idea rewritten by the other author. That's how it felt the whole time. So I highly recommend reading it, but I would read it fast and skip pages and just find the ideas. From my perspective, I think I heard about it originally from Peter Thiel, maybe a decade ago. I'm not even sure exactly, but he was really singing the praises of the book. I've read a lot of his work. I learned a lot from him. Polarizing figure. I don't love everything about Peter Thiel, but I've gleaned a lot of insight from him. And maybe 2018, 2017, I think I read it originally, and it spread like wildfire through the Bitcoin community. And I think for good reasons. One, it comes with a inherent libertarian bias, I would say. And I think Bitcoin adopters, especially earlier on, were almost all libertarian or cypherpunks, meaning that they were already predisposed to the ideas. I would say going forward, most of those folks already own Bitcoin. So the future Bitcoin adopters are going to be less politically aligned. But let's get into the ideas a little bit. Some of the things brought up there were both coming true and very related to Bitcoin. So the authors predicted electronic digital cash, which would be a type of monetary system used with cryptography to prevent anyone from stopping you. So what happens if there's a internet money owned by no one that can't be shut down? That's pretty cool. What happens if we use cryptography to send communications digitally? Okay, now we can all of a sudden communicate and share and spend money without anyone stopping us. Okay, this starts to change the logic of violence, as they say in the book. And so I think the key point is we're entering the information age and from the industrial age. And when you make a massive shift like that, the broad incentives in society also changes. And if you examine those incentives, you can start to squint a little bit and see how the future might unfold. And so they took that transition as the premise. They did a lot of thinking on cryptography. And I think the big takeaway is we're moving from a giant industrialized nation state where the logic of violence would be whoever has the most machines, people, capital, guns, like magnitude power of your country, that's who's going to take over the world. Right. So World War II, how that shook out, America was on top, relatively unscathed. We had this huge industrial base. And no damages from World War II. We also got all the gold during the process. And that sort of set up America to emerge as the future leader, right? Britain before that. But might makes right in that context. Now we have the microprocessor. Now we have the information age. We sort of live in cyberspace increasingly over time. And in that type of environment, size does not actually help you because you don't need more people who aren't productive. You want the most productive density in your operation. And so some of the takeaways there might be smaller nation states are all of a sudden more nimble and more competitive because defense is more important. You can protect your money with cryptography. So instead of a nation coming and stealing your gold, there's no money to steal. Right. So it all of a sudden it changes it from asymmetric offense with the large magnitude of might to asymmetric defense through cryptography. And that essentially aligns perfectly with the Bitcoin thesis. I think Barack Obama called it a Swiss bank account in your pocket, which I think is a good shorthand for what this thing is. No one can stop you from using it. No one can steal it. And it essentially enshrines the First Amendment of speech and the Fourth Amendment of privacy. It's very fundamentally aligned to traditional American values. And so I think it's good for America. We should save that question. That's kind of a longer one. But essentially, we're going into asymmetric defense mode. And I certainly believe that we'll go from, let's say, 300 countries to 3,000 countries over this next saeculum. I think the information age provides that. And I look forward to it. I think we want competition from political jurisdictions rather than, hey, all the land's gone and there's no experiments with politics. I would like to see us embrace the information age. You might say Estonia's leaning in, El Salvador's leaning in, certainly Singapore and Dubai, other places like that. So we have a big change coming. I think some of the underdog nations are going to step up and embrace the new paradigm before some of the laggards.
So pivoting to the global financial crisis, once I started to do a little bit of background on Bitcoin's inceptions, and to be clear that there were lots of people making proposals about starting a digital currency long before 2008. This is something that as a Bitcoin neophyte, I've learned recently. But one of the fascinating things is that it was only about a month after the crash of the fall of 08 really hit that Satoshi Nakamoto put out this white paper online. And I want, for those who don't know, Satoshi Nakamoto was a pseudonymed author believed to be American, though that's not confirmed, who put forward that there needed to be a global digital currency of the kind that Bitcoin has essentially become today, and he gave it its name. How significant do you see the fact that he published his white paper right as the global economy was completely resetting, all these tectonic plates were moving? And what was his basic conclusion about the new terrain that was opening up and the possibilities that it offered to ordinary people?
Yeah, great question. There's a bunch here. Let's unpack. So you alluded to the fact that Satoshi was not the first. That's a really important point. So for decades, early internet pioneers were trying to figure out ways to create electronic cash. The primary, I would say the most influential movement would be called the cypherpunks in the early 90s. They were experimenting with these systems and trying to do electronic remailers, so make email private. And they essentially saw the coming information age and they realized, whoa, this is a pretty awesome tool. However, it makes control and censorship, Big Brother type panopticon, digital panopticon, very easy. And they did not want to walk into a trap. So they were saying, let's make software that preserves digital rights, digital privacy in the information age. And out of that emerged Satoshi, as far as we can tell. You gave us a timeline, 08, 09. And the question would be, is that in direct response to the global financial crisis? And I think the answer is partially yes. Satoshi figured it out around that time, right? There had to be all this pre-work. So he couldn't have released Bitcoin in 1995. The prerequisite technologies were not understood or invented yet. So it came out, it was possible at some point in the early 2000s. But I think it's very fair to say that Satoshi launched it, marketed it, branded it, pitched it, whatever you want to say, with regards to the global financial crisis. He understood the mood and he produced this thing and he framed it around the context. Right. So I think that's absolutely true. And we don't know who Satoshi is. Nobody knows. He disappeared like 13 years ago or something like that. He was only around for a few years of Bitcoin's existence. And because we don't know him exactly, we can only go off his writings and his software and the things he did while he was around. And if you look at those, which many people have, there's a lot of Easter eggs hidden in these different dates and things he said. So one, he launched it in 2009, January 3rd. And in the very first Bitcoin block, he sort of embedded information, which was the newspaper headline in the Times in London on January 3rd, 2009. And the headline was "Chancellor on the Second Brink of Bailout." So on one hand, he's just timestamping by saying, hey, I launched it on the date I said because of the newspaper. But if you look an inch deeper, that's him making a statement about money printing coming out of a financial collapse. And I would say Bitcoin is in some sense a protest to centralized money issuance. And Satoshi also had a quote that said, the root problem with conventional currency is all the trust that's required to make it work. The central bank must be trusted not to debase the currency, but history of fiat currencies is full of breaches of that trust. So that's a pretty powerful statement. He also put his birthday on the message boards as April 5th, 1933, which is also the same date that FDR made Executive Order 6102, confiscating all the gold. So again, he's making a statement politically that you can't confiscate Bitcoin. We saw the failings of gold. We need to evolve this into a better money that can't be captured. And so you put all this stuff together, it's, in my opinion, it's quite clear where Satoshi's motivations are. And I think that using the framing around 0809 was partially luck, partially opportunism. And I think he did a very good job marketing this thing in that context. But again, we're looking at scraps long in the past at this point.
And you mentioned that you studied the 1930s and 40s very closely as you were writing the essay. One of the things that becomes very apparent when you really start to apply the ideas and understand them for not only their historical context in the theory, but their relevance to current events now and the parallels, is that the global financial system in the last year to 18 months or so of World War II was completely restructured and rebuilt. What I think is very important for people to understand is that we are moving toward a complete and total restructuring and reconfiguration of the global financial system sometime probably in the next 5 to 10 years. And that's where the Bitcoin aspect is fascinating to me. How do you see, looking 5 or 10 years down the road, Bitcoin making inroads into whatever system replaces the one we have today?
Yeah, great question. And I do think it's super important to understand the changes that occurred in the 30s and 40s, because most people today, they think about change incremental. It's just one little step, and that's just how society goes, and sort of like a linear one foot in front of the other approach. But that is not how history looks. It's also not how evolution looks. There's a concept called punctuated equilibrium, which is essentially that society or biology or ecosystems, they're actually relatively stable for long periods of time. And then something disrupts the system. Let's say 65 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Earth and killed all the dinosaurs, right? It was the age of reptiles. And if you've charted that out, it's just a steady growth. Asteroid hits, cataclysmic events, dinosaurs die, rise of the mammals. Right. So if you look at it, it's not like cute little evolution. No, no, no. It's like flat, dramatic change, flat, dramatic change. That's how life actually works. And humans are no different. If you look at the 50 years leading into the 30s, it was just incremental change. Even with World War I, didn't really change anything minus the people directly impacted. Then enter the 20s, the period of excess, sort of mirroring our period before the fourth turning here in modern times, and the wheels fell off. Society was in bad shape. What happens? We collectivize. We have the political will to actually make large changes. The IMF, World Bank, and deficit spending. Those are huge changes prior that we take for granted now. We also got Social Security, unemployment, all these things that were totally off the table until things got bad. And now we're entering the 20s. Things are getting bad again. You look around, young people have no hope for the future. They see that the older generations essentially sold out the future. They borrowed against the future, and now the young people have to pay it back. They see things like climate change, which is a can of worms, but I think we're over-indexing for climate change to the point where young people have diagnosable climate change disorder. And this is a problem. We cannot have young people being nihilistic. They should be so optimistic that they come across crazy. That's what young people's role is in society. Their role is to try to change the order when they're young and foolish. And the older people are supposed to be more conservative and be like, hey, you know, some of the things are here for a reason. And that conservatism and progressivism is a tension that we need in society. And so we're running headfirst into that right now. And so to your point, we're going to see changes over this next decade that are so crazy we couldn't even imagine them. And they're already starting. I think COVID was the next leg up in this process. We printed a bunch of money there to the point where inflation's going crazy. We're just airdropping stimmy checks on the population. It's ramping up. Conflicts are ramping up, et cetera. And at this point in time, we have a financial debt problem around the world fueled by deficit spending in governments to the point where the math does not make sense. We don't get our way out of this. We're not paying back the debt as it is. And so we have a couple options here. We can either have a decade of financial austerity, which means dramatically cutting back spending, paying across the population for a long time, and eventually we'll pay back our debt. However, there's no political capital for that type of world. So we are not doing that. So what are we going to do? We're going to try and make the debt be devalued. What does that mean? We're going to make the currency devalued. So we have to inflate away the currency. So our debt, it's the same in nominal terms, but the value of the debt goes down. And so that's the next stage. We have to figure out a way to print a ton of money. Otherwise, the whole world explodes. And so how do we do that? Well, typically war is a good way to spend money. It's easy to convince the population that the barbarians are at the gate and we got to print money to save ourselves. And so COVID, I think we printed a little too much. I think we're spending a little too much in the wars right now with Russia, Ukraine, and tensions in the Middle East and otherwhere. And so I think that's the path we're going down. And what I'm concerned about is we go a little too far down this route and the internet becomes a surveillance state, a digital panopticon. And what does that mean? Well, we already know thanks to Edward Snowden and others, we already know that the governments are spying on all of us. This is breaking constitutional rights, but whatever, we're just kind of doing it and people sort of give up. We have central bank digital currencies coming too. So what happens if the central banks create a new monetary system where they have complete and utter control? In my belief, this is very scary. There's over 100 pilot projects around the world. So this is real. This is not me speculating or being a doomer. This is real. It's happening. And what these central bank digital currencies look like is money issued by the federal government or the Federal Reserve central banks. And if they, on the good side, they can individually give users money in the system who might need it. So they have more control. They can granularity steer the economy. Okay, that sounds like it could be good in some ways. However, if they don't like your political views, your money gets cut off. Sorry, Paul, you had too many steaks last month. Your red meat quota is over. You can't buy meat. Ooh, no, sorry, you can't buy that plane ticket. Your carbon credits are a low this month, right? So they can all of a sudden steer the whole economy in a scary way. And then you have to say, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, as far as I'm concerned, we do not want centralized authorities dictating how other people can live in the world. Number one, I'm against it politically and just ideologically. But number two, it's not a good solution. Historically, centralized decision makers do not make good decisions for the masses. And so part of Bitcoin's value proposition is it recognizes the fact that central planning does not work for most things, especially something as important as the monetary system. And Satoshi said in his quote about trust, and so Bitcoin essentially says you don't have to trust the old white guys setting monetary policy. Instead, you trust a free and open source software project. You trust code. You trust math. You don't trust people. And in that type of world, Bitcoin actually starts to look like a piece of public infrastructure that the whole world can use and no one controls. And in that world, it actually serves as an institution. It serves as a stability force for society. It's not going to feel like that in the short term. In the short term, the old world's dying and Bitcoin's rising. So it's tension. It actually is going to accelerate the change in some ways. However, Bitcoin also serves as a life raft. It serves as a way out of the system and allows individuals to say, ooh, I don't like what's going on here. My purchasing power is going down. I feel more poor every year. Maybe I should put a little bit of my income, a little bit of my surplus and my family into a hard asset that cannot be debased, that serves as the counterforce to the inflationary realities that we're living in, and it's only going to accelerate. So in that world, you save yourself. And then all of a sudden you go, wow, my wealth's going up. I can look long-term. I feel optimistic about the future. I'm going to have kids. Young people aren't having kids anymore. How could you have kids if you have no stability and no optimism of the future? And so again, in these chaotic periods, in these fourth turnings, the supply and demand of order gets way out of whack. So society demands order. We really want stability. However, the supply of order, which typically comes from our institutions, our political institutions, our financial institutions, our social institutions, education, healthcare, all these things, they're in decrepit states. No one trusts these things. And so there's this impulse to latch onto any form of stability. This could be the strongman populist politician. This could be FDR or the New Deal or any or geopolitical conflict. Hey, we're going to war. Any of these things, we'll just like a herd latch onto this thing. And I would like to pitch Bitcoin as an institution that's positive for society. It reflects American values, provides hope, and it actually makes the coming financial collapse and societal collapse less impactful on the individuals. It serves as an escape valve, right? Individuals we talked about can get out. Countries can adopt Bitcoin instead of going bankrupt like El Salvador. Corporations can do this. Communities can do this. And it slowly gets people on the life raft. And then all of a sudden, there's not as many people sinking when the time comes. And I think that this is, if we zoom way out, what this is doing is bringing symmetry between the individuals and the state. Okay, I lean libertarian or whatever that means in modern time. Maybe classical liberal is the right term. I lean that way politically. That's my bias. However, it's practical for individuals and the state to have symmetric power. If the people are too powerful, you get the French Revolution and chaos. If the state's too powerful, you get authoritarian Nazi Germany. You get Mao's reign in China and many, many, many other examples. And so either extreme is poor. You want attention, but you want it to be relatively symmetric so that if we believe in a liberal democracy, the people can actually enact their will on the state. Today, we don't have anything remotely looking like that. So we need way more power in this pendulum to swing back to the people. And guess what? The centralized authority structures, they don't give away power. It's never happened ever and it never will. But instead, technology and changing forces in society force that change. And we force power away from the state and into the individuals. And Bitcoin serves as a check and balance against monetary debasement, against the money printers from just printing ones and zeros and giving them to their friends. And so in that type of reality, if you live in a, let's say a developing country, and your government is printing money like crazy and giving it away to the aristocracy or their friends or whatever, as an individual in those developing countries, you don't have access to the dollar. You don't have access to the US stock market. You go down with the ship. You're being oppressed financially by your state with no way out. That's not a good situation. Enter Bitcoin. Now you live in Zimbabwe, you're hyperinflating Argentina, hyperinflating Turkey, Nigeria. Any of those situations, you just grab a mobile phone, connect to the internet and buy some Bitcoin. That is a protest vote. That is a way to push back against overactive or detrimental monetary policy. And in that type of world, we're empowering people with this emergent order structure that is out of the hands of any government. So this starts to look like a very different world if we fast forward. I would say in 10 years' time, Bitcoin will make a lot more progress, but it's going to take 20, 30, 40, 50 years before I think we're firmly in a world that takes money printing out of the state. And so if we're right, Satoshi is like Prometheus, right? Prometheus stole fire from the gods. The gods punished him for it, but he gave fire to the world, right? Satoshi, in a way, is taking money out of central banks and giving it to the people. And we're lucky Satoshi is pseudonymous, because if Satoshi was around today, he would be Julian Assange. He would be Edward Snowden. He would be martyred in front of the world to see. There's no doubt in my mind. So it looks like Satoshi is a little smarter than Prometheus. Prometheus got caught. Satoshi's, as far as we know, is still out there.
They got a lot of gears turning. And one of the things that I actually was just kicking around, the world financial system and all the structures that go with it. If you're alive today, you've pretty much only known a world in which Keynesianism has been the basic process by which national economies operate and that the world economy operates by. Do you think that there's a possibility, as you said, a long time horizon from now, that people will look upon this era that's coming as kind of the Satoshi system, at least in part?
I do. I do. I think it's instructive to go really big picture here. Gold was converged on by humans as the best natural form of money in our society. We tried beads, we tried glass, we tried rice, we tried salt, we tried all these different things, silver, copper, etc. Eventually, we landed on gold. And the reason is gold has monetary properties, which we can now define with clarity based on studying monetary history. Characteristics like scarcity, divisibility, portability, durability, right? We can break into all these, but it's a kind of a long conversation. But the takeaway is that gold serves as money better than anything else in the world. So gold's been money for thousands of years. And in between gold's reign, there's little moments in time where some political apparatus captures the gold and they sort of change the system for some state's benefit. Right, the king stamps his face on the gold coins and says, here's money. And then over time, as people pay their taxes, the king just cuts a little piece of the gold off of each coin, coin clipping it's called. And then 10 years go by, and instead of each coin being 1 gram of gold, each coin is only half a gram of gold. It's a fake example, but to illustrate the point. And so the state's stealing from you again and again and again. And then to modern times, we had a gold-backed currency in the U.S. and other places up until 1913. In the U.S., we started to treat gold. Let me back up even further. Gold has a fundamental flaw. It's really hard to use in modern-day transactions. What are you going to do? Go buy coffee with a little sprinkle of gold dust? How do you weigh it? How do you store it? How do you know it's actually gold? Right? And gold is also too economically valued per size. So it's really hard to use for small transactions. It's also really hard to move long distances because it's physical and it's easy to get stolen, it's heavy, et cetera. And so what that led to is warehousing gold in a bank. You give the gold to the bank gives you a certificate of deposit or a paper bill, money as we call it now. They give you cash in exchange, which is just a receipt for the gold, or it formerly was. Then what happens is people who have all the gold go, hey, maybe we can issue a few extra paper receipts. No one's going to notice. No big deal. And over time, we've slowly moved off that gold standard. So now our money is not backed by anything. And that detethering to scarcity, which is the key, there's a scarce amount of gold, a finite supply of gold, relatively finite. That keeps the people who are in charge of the mint in control because they can't arbitrarily inflate the money supply. And so essentially gold was co-opted by what you call Keynesianism or fiat money. And so I think when we look back in time, we're going to see this period from, let's say, 1913 to, I'm just calling 2030, something like that, actually as the fiat interstitial. It's a gold system with a temporary fiat period where we went crazy. Also, the 1900s were the period of global war. I think these things are correlated. Also, people will say, well, we did a lot of good in the 1900s. How could it possibly be the fault of gold? Maybe it was actually the benefit of fiat where we saw all this technological progress. However, that is very poor thinking. We don't have a counterfactual. If we kept a gold standard through the 1900s, I would predict less war and way more productivity. And so I think it's a bad argument. Now, looking to the future, you mentioned, are we going to be on the Satoshi standard or the Bitcoin standard? I do believe that Bitcoin will be the largest financial asset, let's say by 2030, maybe 2035, for sure by 2050. So in this type of world, I don't predict that all government monies will disappear. I think that governments and maybe city states in the future, they're going to want some sort of a political control over the money. And so if they back the currency by Bitcoin, issue notes, that's fine. If they have their own currency independent of Bitcoin, that's also fine, because the citizens can say, hey, you're not doing a good job managing the monetary system. I'm going to move more of my wealth into Bitcoin, which essentially takes power from the state. Again, symmetry. It's not a fiat only or Bitcoin only. It's a tension. It's an ecosystem of monetary tools. I just think Bitcoin's monetary properties, primarily scarcity, there's only ever 21 million, that underpins monetary systems quite well. It again enforces the fact that you can't print the money. It sort of defangs that as a system. And I think that's the right foundation to society if we want to have a productive society. And so for me, this is a very optimistic thing. But to your point, in the short term, I have no idea what's going to happen. The fiat system's going to collapse. Luckily, we have Bitcoin as a sort of a hedge or a lifeboat, but the ship's sinking. And without Bitcoin, I would say we're headed to very scary times. With Bitcoin, I think we're still headed to scary times, but individuals, as they learn about this thing, can slowly opt into the new system before the old system totally crumbles.
So we're both millennials. Have you noticed that there is a, have you noticed any generational trends in who Bitcoin's buyers are today, who Bitcoin's buyers have been since the beginning? Who are the top people at the Bitcoin platforms or brokerages now? Is it definitely a generational shift happening in who's comprising these buyers markets and who's going to bat for this new system?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So working at a Bitcoin brokerage, I see, and I'm in charge of revenue, so I see all the customer volumes and their demos. And I know this intimately from our company's perspective, which is only, let's say, 4 years old. So it's not the full picture, but I do have some insight. But I think it's more instructive to start in the early days. So Bitcoin launched in 2009, white paper in 08, software launched in early 2009. At that time, the people who bought Bitcoin were on the absolute fringe of society. These were the cypherpunks. These were maybe some really hardcore libertarians or technology hacker types. People that you would not, most people listening to this have no idea what these people are like. They don't even know this part of society exists. That's how niche it was. Then Bitcoin historically has had these very volatile run-ups in price. It goes up 50x in price and it goes down 80%. It goes up 30x in price and down 80% again, stuff like that. Each time Bitcoin has this rise in price, a social phenomenon occurs where this thing gets hot and people start to pay attention, and a whole bunch of new people come in and buy it and they think it's going up forever. And so each wave of adoption, let's say, brings in a new cohort of adopters. So from that early niche community, and then you might have like a mainstream libertarian type, maybe for the next one in 2013, then fast forward to 2017, I would say it started to break into more of the mainstream culture, but it wouldn't be like the median American. It would be like mainstream people with one foot in society, one foot on, let's say, the vanguard. And so I think what defines early adopters is people who are comfortable going against the herd. It's a new thing. It sounds like a scam when you hear it. Almost no one buys it the first time they hear about it. It usually takes years before people like properly study it, because in our brain, we're like, there's no way some like magic internet money is going to be a big deal, right? Our intuition betrays us, essentially. However, as time moves on, it becomes more embedded in the social fabric. Now, pretty much every American knows someone who owns Bitcoin, or if not many people, right? And so as that tide starts to change, it becomes more socially acceptable for people who maybe don't think for themselves as much, or maybe don't feel comfortable leaving the herd. And I don't mean this disrespectfully. There's a cost. There's a social cost to going against the center of mass of society. It's deeply embedded in our biology. And so the people who adopted early are the risk takers and the weirdos and the fringe, and they benefit the most from taking that risk. And looking to the future, I would say, especially after the Bitcoin ETFs are now live, so the likes of Fidelity and BlackRock, et cetera, they're all benefiting from Bitcoin. And so in that world, I would say we're at the end of the beginning. It's wide open to anyone now. There's no social cost to adopting. So I think the future is everyone buys this thing. And if we look at other trends here, I would say primarily young people were the largest percentage of holders. So technologically savvy, internet culture, a lot more male than female. Those folks are the early adopters. Now, what's interesting at Swan is that we're seeing an enormous cohort of baby boomers who primarily were catalyzed during COVID time, seeing the money printer go off, maybe feeling concerns about their retirement. What about my fixed income? What about this? Am I in good shape here? Those folks are coming to Swan in hordes and buying enormous positions. So I would say at our volume at Swan is probably like 40% baby boomers in terms of dollars spent right now, where 3 years ago it was probably like 10%. In terms of number of users, it's predominantly 25 to 45, I would say. But volume size, it's heavily weighted to older people, primarily because they have more money, to be fair. But it is interesting that the boomers are coming in like crazy. And I also predict that I think another interesting angle here is geography. So I live in the US, you live in the US, probably most of your viewers are in the US or in Western countries. In Western countries, we have strong currencies, we have relatively strong property rights, freedom of speech, rule of law, we can protest our governments relatively well. So in that type of world, all this like revolutionary change the world, push back on the state speech, it kind of falls flat for a lot of people because they look around, they're like, eh, it's pretty good here. But what's interesting is that if you look in developing countries, not even necessarily developing countries, you look outside the US, the correlations with Bitcoin adoption are strongest in areas where the currency is being devalued. So if inflation's high, you buy Bitcoin. If it's authoritarian, you buy Bitcoin. So you start to overlay these things like, well, the state's messing up, rise of Bitcoin. Places like Nigeria, it's like 30% of people own some Bitcoin. Turkey, Argentina, Vietnam, places where individuals need to look out for themselves, it's 20% adoption. In the US, it's maybe 10 to 12%. And so still honestly relatively high, but the real correlations are when the government screws up, people buy Bitcoin.
The age diversity among the buyers, that's interesting to me. Is that a relatively new phenomenon, as you said, since the lockdowns and some of the devaluation of the dollar that went on 4 years ago?
Yeah, I would say the best way to look at it in the early days, let's say the first 10 years, are people feeling comfortable going against the herd? That's the highest correlation. Any age group, any political background, I would say right-leaning or libertarian or whatever, adopted a slightly higher percentage. But there's tons of left-leaning folks who just have like an anti-establishment bent to them. Let's say after 08, the Occupy Wall Street movement, a lot of that same energy, which I was aligned with at the time. However, there was no solution. It was people complaining and yelling into the void. Again, this goes back to how do you change the world? You either vote harder, good luck, or you build tools that get your political wheel enacted, or they can't be shut down or whatever, make the old system obsolete. And so I think that's the old way is ideological. Now I would say, yeah, 2020 is the cycle when the boomers fully came in. That's my view. Plenty don't. Of course, it's still 10, 15% adoption in the US. So most people still don't, but the numbers are growing fast. And at this point in the cycle, what is it? April 2024, Bitcoin's near an all-time high. It's looking strong, but honestly, new waves of adopters are just barely starting to come in. We've seen nothing yet compared to previous cycles. So I would say most of the momentum now is people buying the ETF, smart money, Wall Street, nation states, sovereign wealth funds. That's all coming this cycle. And of course, another wave of retail.
So for people who may not be aware, Neil Howe, who is the one living co-author of this book, The Fourth Turning, we've been discussing, came out with a new book last year. It's called The Fourth Turning Is Here. Brandon, by the way, you also had an opportunity to speak with him. You and one of your colleagues at Swan had a chance to speak with him last year. Was it just before or just after the release of his new book?
Yeah, I think his book came out in the summer, and I think we spoke in the fall, maybe 3 to 6 months after it came out. And I was pestering him from when I found the book, when I wrote the essay, finally, until we had a call. I was like, dude, I'm selling hundreds or thousands of your books. I'm deep in your information. Like, let's have a conversation. We can record it or not. And he was politely declining my request for quite a while. And then I think once the new book finally came out, and he's like, yeah, let's go sell some more books. I think he finally said yes. But we had a very good debate, I would say. The YouTube comments would say, which are mostly Bitcoin people, they're like, why doesn't Neil get it yet? Why is he doing this? And fair enough. Like, he hasn't done the deep dive yet. I think that's true. However, I intended to not slam Neil about the Bitcoin thing and instead make a bridge, because I think he's a establishment DC Democrat. That's where he comes from. He views the state in a very rosy way. He views coming changes. And I would say he doesn't like the political, radical, ideological side of Bitcoin, which is over indexed on Twitter. So his view of Bitcoin is like burn it all down type people, which is actually totally not true. But I don't blame people for coming to that conclusion. Bitcoin people are nuts on the internet. We're very passionate and we have strong beliefs and we fight in public. So it's very abrasive to observe this community for the first time. That's my belief. And I think Neil was slightly turned off by that. However, during the conversation, I explained the perspective of a millennial. I explained how my peers and young people do not have hope for the future. And here are some reasons that align with your book, Neil. Remember, steeped in your ideology as well, overlaps are glaring. And sort of explained the fact that young people view Bitcoin actually as an optimistic way out. And it's slurping up nihilism and it's turning into hopeful young people. And that's what we need. And I think that type of thinking and building up or pitching Bitcoin as an institution, which is essentially what we need to get out of this fourth turning, pitching it that way, I think did land. We traded some emails after that, but honestly, I'm not sure where he's at, maybe a year later now, or maybe even more.
Yeah, my personal assessment, and I'm grateful to Neil, because as is true, I think, of so many people who read The Fourth Turning and came across his and Bill Strauss's ideas, it completely changed my life. I don't want to get too personal with it, but at the point in time when I first discovered those ideas, I was in a pretty rough patch. And there was just something about the way he and Bill wrote, not just The Fourth Turning, but their other works that I picked up, that it just turned on a lot of lights for me for why I had certain experiences, why I had certain priorities and certain perspectives, and why I always knew from the time I was 7 or 8 years old, and I spent a lot of time around older kids when I was growing up, that I just knew that older people were different and I was different from them. And because I graduated from college in 2008, that created a huge point from which my life departed from what it had been before. And mentally, I still have that frame of reference. And when I read their work, it was like, oh, that's why I felt the way that I did when this happened, is because my life just happened to cross paths with this tornado that was headed toward every financial institution in the known universe, that a lot of people were going to pay the price for just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I was. I'll always have a debt to him for explaining certain things to me and giving me a lens to see the world that has just helped me navigate it a little bit better. I do think that he is very caught up, as you said, in a belief that even in 2024, projecting forward and assuming that the construction of the next social order will resemble what happened at the end of World War II. And I think that's a mistake. Do you think that there is going to be eventually enough people, whether they pick up these books and these ideas or not, who will, I guess, intuit is the right word, who will intuit that we are in the midst of something very historic right now that is moving us toward a world that's going to look very different 5 or 10 years down the road? Do you think that people will start to wake up and not be so captive to the narratives that are coming down from on high?
Yeah, interesting question. So I've got a couple of comments on that, and I want to circle back to Neil in our previous chat and where I think he misstepped a little bit. So do I think people will make change, see it coming, adapt? I honestly think that people don't make change until they feel the pain. So you got to touch the stove before you realize, you know, you got to get burned before you realize don't touch the hot stove, whatever. Most people learn lessons through pain. Some people sometimes can observe or learn or empathize with pain of others and prevent that mistake from happening. Ideally, we could all do that, but most people don't. I also think right now people are feeling very stretched financially. And so they're on a treadmill and they're getting poorer every year and they don't know why. And it sucks and it really bothers people, but they don't know where to place that. This leads to escapism, nihilism, not having kids, a whole bunch of little things come out of that that are negative. And so I don't think it's going to happen. However, as things get worse and worse and worse, we do see more people realizing like, hey, something's off. I need to learn what's going on and better myself. And so I think moments of pain, let's take 2020, 2021, COVID, money printing, you know, mash all that together. That woke a lot of people up that the system's not working as they thought. And if they want to make their life better, they're going to have to make a change. And so as this fourth turning wraps up, as we escalate towards the peak climax, I think increasingly more people will save themselves. But on a percentage basis, the numbers aren't going to be very large. Most people will just go with the flow. They don't think long term. And they're just a product of their environment. I don't think people like hearing that, but I do believe that at least 70% of people, if not higher, don't really have much agency in the world. And it's not a bad thing. It's a totally fine way to live. Most people do it. We're biologically trained this way. But I do believe that very few people make large impacts in the world. Small ideas have outsized impact in the world. And so that's my belief. And so as we go in this world, no, it's going to just get worse and worse and worse. It's going to, new order is going to emerge and people will look back in 5, 10, 20 years and they'll be like, oh man, I should have bought more Bitcoin. It's so obvious in retrospect. And so I foresee that coming. Any comments there before I circle back to Neil a little bit?
I think that you're right. I think your basic point is correct. The thing that is dismaying to me is, again, all these signs are there that we are living through something that is really different than anything that anybody alive today has experienced. Mm-hmm. And yet there is, I believe, a basic instinct to not want to really shake things up and be willing to see the world differently until you experience a heck of a lot of pain. Maybe in some respects, that's why I got into these ideas, because I went through a tough time in my life in the years leading up to when I discovered them, but I had to educate myself that whatever's coming is going to envelop not just me, but everybody else.
Yeah. And to add on that one more time, I think the premise is that people feel it unconsciously. So they know that they don't know why. Life is getting harder. They feel like they can't get ahead and they don't know why. I think that's the majority of people. And I actually don't foresee that changing. I think that's how they're going to live. I don't think that, yeah, it'll get worse and it'll wake up some people, but most no. And I think that's okay. They'll come out the other side in worse shape, but hopefully they can have a good life and that the new order works for more people, which I believe it will. To Neil, he has an idea in the new book, which I would say the new book was fine. I've absorbed the ideas so much that there wasn't much new stuff for me there. There was new narratives, new arguments, new details, which I appreciate. And I would read any book he publishes, so keep coming. But I wouldn't say it was revolutionary for me in any way. I thought it was like a rehash and some modern ideas. Fine. He cashed in on his ideas. I would have done the same thing. In terms of America, one idea that stood out for me, though, was the idea of the America's Fourth Republic. So he essentially said each fourth turning brings apart a new implementation of America's Republic. And I thought that was a really cool way to look at this. Now, where I diverge with Neil is he kind of thought the new republic would be a sort of a techno-socialist, big brother, mega state, we're all in it together in like a, you don't need privacy, just eat the bugs kind of a view, which I found to be very bearish. It's not something I can get behind. And so where I diverged, and I had this conversation pretty seriously, and actually, let me quote Ben Franklin first. It was during the Continental Congress, but the question was, they left the Continental Congress as they're creating the Constitution. And someone said, whoa, what kind of government did you make? And Benjamin Franklin said, a republic, if we can keep it, which I think kind of tells the story well. So my argument to Neil was, we are not going into this Or we might go into an authoritarian techno state, to be clear. We're trending that way. If you don't think too hard, that's where we're going. That's where China's going. But I think Bitcoin and original American principles do have a chance of reemerging here. And so in my opinion, the next Saiklem will be more like OG America and less like his less like China's view of the future. So this is distribution of power. This is individual property rights. This is smaller central government, more empowered localism. And I think in this world, a Bitcoin-based property rights system is a way to implement OG American values in a way that will be both good for individuals and good for the country. America has the best geography. We have great energy security, great food security, great border security, minus the recent southern border issue. But geographically, we have water on two sides and two friendly countries. We hit the jackpot. We have the innovation. We have the best form of government today. We have the monetary reserve currency. We have innovation here better than anywhere else. It's our game to lose. And it's my belief that if we go into the next world and we try to be more like China, which is authoritarianism, if we try to go that route, it's not going to work for the people. And we're going to have a worse version. We're not going to be able to do it like China does. So we're going to have like a authoritarianism thing. And it's going to be civil war, in my belief, if they try to push that too hard. On the other hand, we can lean into OG American values, which means we pretty much need to drain the swamp. I don't mean to quote Trump here, but we kind of do need to make a radical shift. And I think Bitcoin sort of can force that issue in a way where it says, like, yeah, you can go play politics, but you can't do the money anymore. Because if you screw up the money, we're just going to leave and go to Bitcoin. And I think that alone is the force we need. And I think people will say yes to this because it is so deeply American in values. And I think that's good for the country. So let's go OG America for the next one. The next point I want to pick on with Neil is a shorter point, which is he's essentially saying, like, there's no way people are going to trust Bitcoin. What if I lose my password? I like to go to the bank branch and look them in the eye and shake their hand and get my money out. What's funny about this is Neil wrote the book. He explained how ideological the boomers are and how hard it is for people from previous cycles to see the future. And so he's a meme of himself. It's this palpable irony here that he doesn't see the fact that young people do not see Bitcoin the same as he does. In fact, young people don't want to go to the bank. They don't trust the bank. They don't trust the government. They don't trust the central banks. So reality is already not on Neil's side. And I think that the trust in Bitcoin accelerates as Bitcoin gets larger, as more people understand it, as more people adopt it, right? That's the trend. And he would have to be the one defending the trend. He would have to be the one saying the trend is going to revert if he wants to make that case. I don't think he can make that case very strongly. So Bitcoin's going to be more trusted over time. More people are going to adopt it. Old people are going to die and young people are going to step up as demography goes. And in that type of world, it's going to be more and more likely that Bitcoin becomes widely adopted.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And with respect to his basic conclusion in the new book that we are headed toward, he said the fourth American Republic, is that right? I think he gave that statement the first time near the end of the first chapter. And I sort of thought to myself, well, he just broke down all the reasons that things are spiraling out of control today. And he just leapt from all of that, which I think was about 8 or 9 or 10 pages of why everything has gotten so bad and so chaotic, to it's going to work itself out in the end. And I thought to myself, well, I'll be very interested to see how he bridges that argument over the rest of the book. And at times I did think he's basing his most hopeful lens on this, on comparisons to the past, not the diagnostic assessment of the country as things are he gave in the very beginning. He's written amazing books. He co-wrote some books that have changed the lives of so many people, including you and I. These ideas need to evolve. And people who are concerned and have legitimate concerns that we are headed towards something exactly like what you described, not just the potential for serious civil conflict or civil war in this country, but an authoritarian techno state on the other side, should heed the basic principles that are laid out in his work, but think independently for themselves about what they could mean for the future based upon what they are seeing and experiencing, not necessarily what someone else is predicting.
Well said. I think it's poetic, right? Neil pitches the cyclical nature of life and how it shows up everywhere. And he understands these ideas better than anyone. I think that's objectively true. But we can escape our stage of life. We can escape our bias, our way that we make decisions. And I think that Neil is no longer seen as clearly, he's not seen as clearly as he could be for the future. And he is over-indexing on the past. And I don't think he's aware of these biases. And I don't think that it's necessarily his fault. I think he's in the stage of life where that is a really hard thing to ask, right? We do get rigid in our thinking as time goes on. It's harder to integrate new ideas. It's harder to imagine radical change when you haven't seen it for so long. Like, the world's cemented in your view at like age 25. One definition of technology is essentially anything created after I turn 25 is technology, and anything before that is the way it was or the way it always was or something like that, kind of illustrates that. And so maybe it's time for people to carry Neil's torch into the future. And maybe we're playing some small role in that right now.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. And as we wind down here, you mentioned that there is a possibility that we could go the way of China in terms of the relationship between government and society. They're starting to implement or at least test central bank digital currency there. Or I know they have a social credit system in place, but do they actually have a working CBDC right now?
Not mass. It's not rolled out to the entire country. They have provincial pilots all over the place. Yeah, they're trying to figure out the incentives and make it work and slowly convince the people it's a good idea. As far as I know, there's no countrywide full implementations, but we're getting closer every year. And even Western countries like the US are playing around with it. However, the devil's in the details. There's a lot of ways to implement this thing. China will do it their way. I do believe we're going to try. Europe's pretty far along as well. I think we're going to experiment with these things in the West, but we're going to do it with our flavor. So I actually predict the US will be more of a federated model, which would involve keeping private companies involved. Because essentially, if you do a central bank money, you squeeze out the commercial banks. Most of the monetary creation or money printing today is actually just debt created by commercial banks. And so I think the US will try a similar model. There's no way we're going to squeeze out all the Jamie Dimons of the world. I just don't see it happening. So I think we'll have more of a federated model. It'll feel more free, but the end result will be quite similar. And so, hey, it might work for a while. They're going to say, hey, if you sign up to the new system, we're going to give you your $1,000 a month UBI. We're going to give you, if you want to get a social thing from the government, unemployment or whatever, you're going to have to sign up for the app. And so they're going to get us on this thing. But I think ultimately it's still going to be a deflation or an inflationary currency. And if you're paying attention to your wealth, you're still going to go adopt Bitcoin. And so I think it's like a one more attempt at keeping the old system alive. It might keep it going for another decade, but I think ultimately math will determine the fact that we need a monetary reset. Could it be violent? Yes. Could it be slow and steady? Yes. I don't know what's going to happen, but it has to happen.
And as we close out here, I want to give a recommendation to you and to anyone listening who may not have heard of someone named Angelo Codevilla. He was a international relations research fellow, author, former government official, I think in the Reagan administration. So he'd been a DC insider for a time, who about 14 or 15 years ago began to write about the concentration of power among the already powerful in America after the global financial crisis. We hear so much talk today about the ruling class, and he didn't come up with the term. I want to be clear about that. But in a series of writings over many years, he gave such a clarion clear picture of who these people are and what their intentions are for America, in large measure because of how they see ordinary Americans. Of all the people whose, if you want to call it prophecies, like the fourth turning, of all the people whose prophecies from years past are coming true today and who are just being proven as totally Brilliant. Angelo Codevilla is a name I recommend people look up. His last name is spelled Codevilla. His writings on the American ruling class and political correctness and where the American Republic is going based upon all these developments that have been essentially, that were essentially unleashed by the global financial crisis and the aftermath of it. It will open a lot of eyes. He opened my eyes. He's been a big influence on me. He sadly passed away, I think, untimely about 3 years ago. I hope as time goes along, people discover him and his work more and more, because he's one of those people who has just been proven right about a lot of things. And knowing how right he's been proven to be should give a lot of smart, independent, resourceful, community-minded, pro-American people another push to essentially fight for what they believe in.
Good pitch. It arrives at my house on Tuesday. Just ordered it. So thank you for the recommendation.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time. This conversation's been a long time coming. Really admire your work. I'll continue to look for things that you write, both on your own website as well as at swan.com. Is there anything you'd like to pitch?
Yeah, if any of the ideas worked for you or you want to read more or talk more, come say hello on Twitter. My DMs are open. My handle is B Quiddum, B for Brandon, last name Quiddum. All writings go to brandonquiddum.com. If you're interested in exploring Bitcoin further, you want to learn about it, you want to buy some, swan.com is our website there. If you go to swan.com/Quiddum, my last name, you can sign up there. You'll get $10 in free Bitcoin just for creating an account. It takes minutes to sign up. And we just made a change where we're not going to take any fee. We're not going to charge you any fee for your first 10,000 in purchases. If you're already a customer, it would apply to your next 10,000. So you get the most Bitcoin for your dollar at Swan. Nowhere else in the world can you get that deal today. And yeah, you might as well get some. The right allocation could be anywhere from 0.5% to 100%. You can make an argument anywhere in that range, but 0% allocation to Bitcoin is not the right number. Yeah, it'll be obvious in hindsight, just like all paradigm shifts are. Buy a little today, pay attention, learn about this thing. I think your future self will appreciate you for it.
Great. And last but not least, I want to recommend once again, people check out Brandon's conversation with Neil from last year, which you can find, I believe, on Swan's YouTube page. A really interesting conversation between two big picture thinkers with somewhat different perspectives, but conversation is civil and engaging and touches a lot of bases. And I would really recommend people check that out as well. So thanks again. And we'll hope to catch up with you down the road. Thanks for being a guest on the Generation Report.
Thank you, Paul. I admire your work as well. Glad we finally got to do this, and I hope to do it again in the future.
All right. Thanks, Brandon. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.